this is your Polycast for Thursday, November 17th, your daily check-in on Minnesota politics. I'm Mike Mulcahy in the Minnesota Public Radio newsroom. On today's edition, charges against a police officer in the death of Philando Castile and the new Republican leader in the Minnesota Senate. Manslaughter charges against a St. Anthony police officer in the death of Philando Castile mark a historic turn in authorities' approach to police use of deadly force in Minnesota. There's been nothing like it in decades at least, and possibly ever. Tim Nelson has more.
Officer Geronimo Yanez's traffic stop of Philando Castile on July 6th turned tragic and well-known as Castile's girlfriend captured the 32-year-old's death on Facebook Live. But charges against Yanez have revealed new details of the encounter based on video and audio recorded when Castile, who was African-American, was pulled over. A criminal complaint says after Yanez asked for his driver's license, Castile told the officer he had a gun. Ramsey County Attorney John Choi described what followed in a press conference yesterday.
Officer Yanez screamed, "Don't pull it out," and quickly pulled his own gun with his right hand while he reached inside the driver's side window with his left hand. Officer Yanez pulled his left arm out of the car and then fired 7 shots in rapid succession into the vehicle.
Choi said both sides of the incident were captured on a squad car dash cam, although it couldn't see inside Castile's car, but Yanez's microphone picked up the sound.
Philando Castile moaned and uttered his final words, "I wasn't reaching for it."
Now Yanez faces second-degree manslaughter and felony firearm charges. Tyrone Terrell is chair of St. Paul's African-American Leadership Council and welcomed the charges and an examination of the circumstances surrounded the shooting, saying such scrutiny of police was too long coming.
Well, I think what it shows that you cannot just execute a black man because of a perceived danger that he has a gun or you think he's been a suspect in a robbery.
Those circumstances include Yanez's own potentially incriminating admission, recorded on a squad car microphone moments after the shooting. John Choi said Yanez's story changed after the fact.
Officer Yanez's verbatim statement, included in the criminal complaint, is inconsistent with the statement he made immediately following the incident, in which he stated he never saw or knew where the gun was.
The charges say paramedics found a pistol in Castile's front shorts pocket after he'd been shot as he sat belted into the driver's seat of his car. Investigators don't believe he ever tried to draw the weapon. And the county attorney said the fact that another officer never drew his weapon indicates there was another way to respond. The charges drew approving statements from the NAACP, the ACLU, and Governor Mark Dayton, as well as Castile's family, who were told of the decision to file charges on Wednesday night. Attorney Glenda Hatchett, who represents Castile's family, commended Choi's approach, despite questions by some who thought Yanez should face tougher charges.
The worst thing that could happen is that the officer is overcharged and he is found not to be responsible for those charges.
Hatchett said a federal lawsuit is likely to follow. A federal prosecutor has also joined the case. A spokesman for the U.S. Attorney's Office said that didn't mean federal charges would necessarily be filed, but that it didn't preclude possible civil rights charges either. A statement from Sean Gormley, the executive director of the union that represents St. Anthony police officers, said the death of Castile has been tragic for his family and the community. Gormley added, quote, "It's important to remember that Officer Yanez is innocent of these charges until proven guilty. Nobody is served by a rush to judgment." Yanez is expected to make his first court appearance tomorrow afternoon. Tim Nelson, Minnesota Public Radio News.
A final group of 3 Twin Cities men were sentenced to decades in prison for terrorism charges yesterday, including trying to join the terror group ISIS and conspiracy to murder outside the United States. Dawahali Saikautau reports the co-defendants were part of what a federal judge described as a terrorist cell in Minnesota.
This was the largest ISIS recruitment case in the country. The six men who pleaded guilty received sentences ranging from time served to 15 years. The last three, who took their cases to trial, received 30 years or more. The sentencing hearings were filled with tension, emotion, and tight security throughout the courthouse. U.S. District Judge Michael Davis repeatedly drove home the message that there is, in his words, a jihadist cell in this community. He said, "Its tentacles spread out. Young people went to Syria and died." And speaking to one defendant, Davis said, "The lies you told should be published so there's no doubt of what's happening here." All the co-conspirators were friends, and the nine who were sentenced are between 20 and 22 years old. Over 3 days, the young men spoke of their isolation in their family or community, of religious curiosity, of wanting to find purpose and meaning in their lives, finding it apparently in ISIS propaganda videos. Often, Judge Davis asked the defendants if they saw themselves as terrorists, and some replied, "Yes, I am a terrorist, Your Honor." But one of the defendants, Mohammed Farah, said he recognized the actions he took are what terrorists would do, but he told the judge, quote, "I feel like I'm not a terrorist, Your Honor." Immediately, Davis stopped Farah from speaking and said, "Let's not play games. Your cell lied, 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 and deceived, deceived, deceived to go to the Islamic State." Farah then replied, "Yes, Your Honor." When Davis asked Farah's parents, Ayan and Abdihamid Farah, to step up to the front of the courtroom for questioning, he told them, quote, "I would never want to be in your place, having two sons that are going to go to prison." The mom then told the judge of her heart problems and insomnia, and the father, speaking through a translator, talked about how he felt his children were misled. But the judge cut him off and shouted, "You respect me. Whatever anger you may have about him being here, he is alive." Adnan Farah, the couple's second son, who is 20, pleaded guilty and received a shorter sentence of 10 years. The longest sentence of 35 years was given to Guled Omar, described as one of the emirs or leader of the group. During his statement in court, Omar apologized to his mother in Somali and told the court, "I looked to the wrong places for answers, but ISIL and its propaganda did take advantage of me. I was vulnerable. I was lost," he said. But Judge Davis, before sentencing Omar, told him, "Everything you've said here, I don't believe." Outside the courthouse, nearly 100 people gathered to protest the sentences, including Ayan Farah, the mother of defendants Mohammed and Adnan Farah.
She says for the past 3 days, the boys have been humiliated over and over again. They were stripped of their dignity. They were told to say degrading things about themselves that will possibly carry on for the rest of their lives and even after they're released.
Matthew Palombo, who has taught thousands of Somali-American students at Minneapolis Community and Technical College, said he was disappointed in the sentences by Judge Davis. The two men who cooperated with the government received the lightest sentences.
It's sad that the differences of sentencing from 2 or 3 years to 35, despite the fact that these kids more or less did the same thing, and the only thing that the judge has communicated is it's not about what you did or who you are. It's about how much you worked with the FBI.
Palumbo, who has befriended defendant Guled Omar, said Omar and the other men took responsibility for their actions and their words and have taken steps to reform themselves and better themselves for re-entry into the community, although that may not happen for decades. Dua Li Saikautau, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
A former DFL legislator says he's gearing up for a run for Minnesota Attorney General in 2018 if the incumbent moves on. Former Representative Ryan Winkler says he's formed a campaign committee to start building toward a run. He says he would run only if three-term Democratic Attorney General Lori Swanson doesn't.
I think the office is too important to wait until the last minute to try to put together a campaign. You know, for me, I guess there's always the possibility that I put in a lot of time and effort, and ultimately the attorney general decides to seek re-election and I stand down.
Winkler is a lawyer who represented a Golden Valley district in the state house. He resigned from the legislature in 2015 when his wife took a job abroad. He split his time between Belgium and Minnesota, but intends to move back full-time next year. A DFLer has occupied the Secretary of State's office for 45 years. An insurance agent from Nisswa is now one of the most powerful lawmakers in Minnesota, and he's as surprised as anyone by that newfound status. Senate Republicans picked Paul Gazelka as their new majority leader last week after they won a narrow one-seat advantage over Democrats. Gazelka says his plan headed toward the 2017 session is to keep his 34 members united and to find consensus with Democrats when possible on big issues. Tim Pugmire has the story.
Paul Gazelka and his Senate Republican colleagues were busy this week setting up a new leadership team, designing a new committee structure, and packing up to move into the office space across the street where Senate Democrats currently reside.
Well, about a week ago, this was not anywhere near my radar.
Gazelka's rapid ascension was the result of a key Election Day loss for Republicans, even as they picked up the majority. Senate Republican leader David Hahn was defeated in his Eden Prairie district. Gazelka praised Hahn as an effective and honorable minority leader and said he was grateful to be chosen as his successor.
My leadership style may be slightly different than his. I don't want to try to fill his shoes. I want to simply, use the talents that I have.
Gazelka is pro-gun, anti-abortion, and supports traditional marriage. Last session, he introduced a bill to allow businesses and organizations based on religious views to deny marriage-related services to same-sex couples. But he says those kind of issues might not be immediate priorities. Gazelka said the approach will be different from the last time Republicans were in charge of the Senate in 2011 and 2012, when they passed constitutional amendments that voters ultimately rejected to ban same-sex marriage and require a photo ID to vote.
I think there was an exuberance about we can change everything. And those of us that are still here realize that you can't get everything done right away. It doesn't work as well that way. And so we really are interested in building consensus and moving towards the things that we know we need to accomplish.
Gazelka says health care, transportation funding, and tax relief are the top issues in 2017. He said other issues, including the social issues that he's championed throughout his time in the legislature, can wait. But DFL Senator Scott Dibble of Minneapolis, who carried the legislation that legalized same-sex marriage in Minnesota, said he's extremely concerned about the agenda of Senate Republicans under Gazelka's leadership.
These bills are going to be heard, and they're going to be passed, and they're going to be put on the governor's desk, and it's going to be very, very painful and very, very difficult for a lot of Minnesotans because they're going to be told by the legislature that they don't count and they don't matter and who they are isn't welcome in our state, and I think that's a shame.
Despite those concerns, Dibble says he views Gazelka as friendly and approachable, even when it's to discuss deep disagreements about policy. Senate Republicans are already showing a unified front in praise of their new leader. GOP Senator Gary Dames of Redwood Falls, who has served alongside Gazelka since 2011, said he thinks the caucus made an excellent choice.
I think we're all on the same page. I think we're going to move some real good legislation forward, and I think that we've got a very strong leader.
For Gazelka, being a respectful listener is part of who he is and also part of the plan moving forward as Senate Majority Leader.
You know, I am a person of deep Christian faith, but I respect people and respect that they have different views than mine. We're all different. And I think the better we can just honor people, no matter where they're coming from, no matter their position in life, no matter their viewpoints in life, it's amazing what we can do.
Gazelka's approach will be tested next session when the Senate and the Republican-controlled House begin sending bills to DFL Governor Mark Dayton. Gazelka stressed that he's already on friendly terms with Dayton, but he noted that they're both passionate about their differing political beliefs. Covering politics, I'm Tim Pugmire, Minnesota Public Radio News.
And that's your Polycast for this Thursday, your daily check-in on Minnesota politics. I'm Mike Mulcahy in the Minnesota Public Radio Newsroom.